MechCast Tuesday, September 18th, 2018. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, it is a big episode today. I've got a lot of stuff to talk about, because I have spent the last, 7-8 days just going through all of the details that happened after Apple's special event. I guess it's been a little less than that. They did it last Wednesday, so I guess we're almost at about 6 days here, but just been processing through everything. I know you have a lot of questions. You've been emailing me. You have a lot of comments, and we're going to get into all of those. So this episode's pretty much going to be all about the new iPhones and Apple Watch. That's what we're going to be talking about almost exclusively. Hopefully, we'll hit on and touch all the details of all your questions. We'll also talk about a little bit about iOS 12, which just came out along with Watch OS 5 and all the other OS updates, iOS updates to software, tvOS, you know, all those OS, mobile OS operating systems came out and were updated. And then we're also, of course, fully expecting another event probably next month. But there's plenty to talk about today, so I don't think we need to waste any time. I think we're going to jump right into it. I wanted to start off giving you some of my quick initial thoughts on the Apple event and how things went after the Apple event. I'm actually going to work my way backwards just a little bit and talk about, because I know a lot of you want to know about, did I order an iPhone XS or XS Max or a XR, whatever iPhone I might be interested in, or Apple Watch? Was I going to pre-order any of that stuff? And I had said on a prior MacCast and on some other podcasts that this year I wasn't so sure. You know, with the rumors leading up to the event, I really felt I have an iPhone X. I spent a lot of money on it, and I'm not feeling like there's going to be enough in there to warrant the upgrade. Now, I'm in a little bit of a different situation than your standard person who's going to upgrade to an iPhone. Maybe many of you. In many ways, because I do the podcast, it's part of my job to kind of know about the latest technologies from Apple, how those things work and stuff like that. But, you know, looking at the lineup, I was feeling like, no, you know, I don't probably need to upgrade. There's not enough new in there that I'm going to need to talk about. Well, watched the keynote, and really what put me over the top and made me ultimately decide, yep, I'm going to upgrade from my iPhone X to an iPhone XS because I don't like the large sizes. If you've been listening to the MacCast for a long time, the reason behind that is I tried an iPhone 6 Plus. I think that was the vintage that I tried the large size on, and it just wasn't the size for me. It was too big, didn't fit in my front pocket. That's how I like to carry my phone. The iPhone X size is really pushing that. So the fact that the XS remained the same size, that's good for me. But what pushed me over the top in terms of upgrading was not so much any of the changes, because really a lot of the stuff was under the hood, right? It was processor, better GPU, but in terms of like the camera systems and things like that, most of it remained the same, with one huge exception, and we're going to talk about it more on this podcast, but it is the Neural Engine. The updates to the Neural Engine, which is what Apple uses for augmented reality stuff, for artificial intelligence stuff, and also for a lot of the new camera processing stuff, that made me go, yep, I probably need to have this, because there's going to be new software, new applications coming out. Apple has done a bunch of things that are exclusive to the iPhone XS series camera system, the new 10 series. We got to have a name for this, because it's the XS, XS Max, and the XR. Those things as a group, I'm just going to refer to those as the new 10S series. So all those things together. I know R doesn't fit in with the S, but for lack of a better term, just know from this point forward on the MacCast, we're going to call it that, because otherwise it's going to get crazy with me talking to you through all these names. So in the new 10S series, those changes to the camera system, I think, are significant enough, and I'm going to get enough questions from the community, and I'm going to want to be able to test those things out firsthand. So that's why I ultimately pulled the trigger and ended up ordering one. I pre-ordered. We'll talk a little bit more in this episode about how that whole process went. And actually, let's jump right into that now. the process of ordering this year was super easy. There were no issues in ordering whatsoever. You know, typically on the launch days, you're getting up, it's midnight. If you're outside of the West Coast, you're getting up at 3 a.m. on the East Coast, other parts of the world, crazy hours, lining up. You're hoping that you can get in. You try to do all the advanced pre-setup that you can. And Apple really was on the ball with that this year. I went into the App Store app on my phone. I was able to set up and get pre-qualified because I decided to go on the annual upgrade program or the Apple upgrade program. And my rationale behind this, and I know that I've spoken out against the program in the past, and I still fundamentally feel like it doesn't really matter. You're ultimately spending the same amount of money no matter what because it's essentially an interest-free loan. And I just personally feel I'd rather pay for it all up front. But things how they are in my life right now, that wasn't going to be really possible this time around. If I wanted to upgrade, it was going to be a big hit, a big chunk of money. And so I just found it was going to be easier to go on the upgrade program. I'm still going to pay it off in 12 months, maybe even sooner. But just timing of everything was weird with how things are going on in my life right now. So I decided that's how I was going to go ahead and get it. And they made that process super easy. So I went in, I was able to get pre-qualified, pre-set up, and also put in my cart the model that I wanted. I'm getting the 10S, 256 gigabytes. I don't feel like I need the 512. I probably don't even need the 256. And looking at my current iPhone 10, I have a 256 model, and I think there's about 180 gigabytes still free on it because I'm using iCloud storage. So I maybe could have gone a little less, but I like having the headroom. I think that's a nice size. But a lot of you are very excited about the 512. I don't know what all of you are loading on your phones. Maybe you don't. I stick to managing my photos pretty tightly, and I am using iCloud Photo Library, which I absolutely love. So I don't have a lot of photos stored on my phone, and I don't leave a bunch of stuff in the camera roll. I also don't take a lot of video. So I don't know. You know, I like the camera features, but I kind of don't do a ton of iPhone photography. So that storage seems to work best for me. So I'm getting the Space Gray. Yep, very traditional. And I'm not probably replacing my case. I'm going to go in and look at the iPhone leather cases. I like Apple's leather case. That's my favorite case to have on my phone, and I usually have it from day one. So I have a saddle brown one now. I love how it's aged. It looks beautiful, but I'm kind of intrigued by the new blue and some of the new colors of cases that Apple has out there. But I think I'm going to go into an Apple retail store and look at that, and because it's exactly the same size, I'm going to be able to use my current iPhone case on my new iPhone XS. So I'm looking forward to that. But back to that ordering process thing. So I pre-set up everything. Midnight rolls around 12:01 a.m. on the Pacific Coast. I fire up the app. It has my order ready to go. It's like one button click, order, you're done. It did ask me to confirm my payment information, and I had double checked that up all up front, making sure I had the right credit card in there and everything was good to go there. Press the button. I think it said thank you. It went really fast. Here's the problem. It went really fast, and I went, oh, I think it's ordered. The problem was is there was then a delay, so if you went back to the app and you looked at your orders, it kept telling me there was no order, and I didn't get an email. So for about 20 minutes, I was a little bit in a panic mode, and I confirmed on Twitter other people were having the exact same experience. So you may have had the same experience where you got your order in, it went so fast and so quick compared to years past where I'm used to there being some sort of problem, having to go back, having to re-press the order button. I almost placed a second order, which I've also done in past years, but I decided to wait it out, not panic, again, because it was looking online like there wasn't the massive pre-order frenzy. And I think that's because you've got the iPhone XR, which is coming out later. Oh, and I guess I didn't bring this up front. The whole naming thing, yeah, I'm not a big fan. You know, Apple can do whatever they want. iPhone XS kind of makes sense because of the whole, it's an incremental update to the 10. The Max thing, I'm not buying what they're selling there. I think they could have gone with Plus and kept it consistent. The argument was it's not just a it's just not an upgrade to the 8 Plus. You know, it's an entirely new phone, and they wanted a different name to kind of signify that. Okay, fine, Phil. I understand what you're going for there. I'm not really buying it. I think your marketing team has gone crazy. And then the 10R, which is the LCD model, I don't know what's going on there. I have no idea what happened there. And I'm assuming you all already know about all the new models. It's been, you know, 6 days at this point. I'm pretty sure you've gotten through your news feeds or just even through the regular media what all of the new phones are. So we're not going to go into too much of that in this episode, because what I really want to get down to is the details, the nitty-gritty, the stuff you might have missed, the stuff you maybe didn't know about. So anyway, got my order in. That was good to go. Dates did start slipping on some of the iPhone XS Max models about an hour after ordering started, and it looked to me like it was, of course, it was going in the natural progression. It was the new largest size phone in the largest storage capacity in the color gold, which is the new color. So all the things that are new, that's what the early adopters want. So that's what they were going for. So those were selling out and backing up into October. And then the next morning, there was general availability on most phones, it seemed like. You could go on and order, and then some models started getting pushed back into October. Similar thing was happening with the Apple Watch. Now, I'm not ordering an Apple Watch this year, but there were some nice surprises there, and we'll get into those in a minute. But the Apple Watch Series 4 did start to slip into October delivery fairly quickly. And for the iPhone XR, that's not on pre-order until the 19th of October, so that didn't really factor into it, and that's going to be shipping on the 26th of October. But, you know, overall, just general thoughts on the keynote, on the event. I've heard from some of you who say you were really disappointed with the keynote, and I think expectations going into the keynote is a lot of what happens, and there's a lot of personal stuff that factors into it. Right, I wasn't expecting a lot out of the announcements, so I was really surprised. We had some surprises in there, some things that we didn't hear leaked, believe it or not. Most of the stuff was leaked, and most of the leaks were very accurate, which I know is also disappointing for some people. I did feel like some of the demo things that they did drug on a little bit longer than they should have. It was probably a longer keynote than it really needed to be, because they were really focused on two, if you count the iPhone XR, three products. Tim Cook called it two products. Two product lines is really what they were focusing on. But overall, I was really impressed. I thought there's some great stuff in there. It was pretty good pacing. Probably didn't need to be as long as it was, but it was great. And I really wasn't surprised that they only focused on two products. I know some people who are disappointed. They were disappointed because there was no Mac stuff. There was no iPad stuff, which we thought we might get. But I don't know why I thought that, because Apple has always historically done a separate event in October for the Macs and the iPads. And that's probably going to happen this year. I fully expect it to happen this year. So I think that will be going on. But I was really happy that there were a few surprises in there. And the neural engine enhancements, that's part of the A12 processor. Those were huge. They really beefed that up. We're going to get into some of the details about that a little bit later. It's enabling a lot of the new photography features. A lot of the photography features this time around are happening with that processor, with what Apple is calling, or I guess other people have called, computational photography. So not so much focusing on the lens system and the physical stuff, the sensors and things like that, although there were some improvements to the camera sensor on the wide angle lens. It's more about using the processor and the image signal processor to do things with photos in real time graphics processing and stuff like that. So detecting and masking out in real time things, so you can do things like the new depth of field feature. And that depth of field feature, which is exclusive to the new XS series of phones, that is really what ultimately made me say, yep, I got to pull the trigger. Because again, I know a lot of you are going to be asking, how does that work? Does it, you know? And I think also, third-party apps are going to start to take advantage of some of those other neural engine enhancements, and some of those features might end up being exclusive to the new phones. The other huge surprise was just the details of the 6.1-inch LCD model, the iPhone XR. I was not expecting it to match the core features of the new flagship phones, the XS and the XS Max. It is almost the same in every single way, with a few minor exceptions that I don't think
are that big a deal. And we've never really had that before. We usually have the flagship models, and then you have the prior year model, which in this case would have been the iPhone X, dropping down in price to the price point that the iPhone XR is coming in at. So now you have the XR coming in at that entry-level price point. The iPhone X has gone away, but really, the XR is a better replacement than the 10 would have been at that slot. So I think that is awesome, and I was blown away by that. So that was great in the announcements. The Apple Watch Series 4, I think the huge thing there and the big surprise there was we kind of knew there was going to be some additional medical stuff, but we have the fall detection, which I hadn't heard that rumored at all. I don't remember talking about it on the show. I don't think that was leaked. We had heard that Apple was looking to do ECG stuff in the Apple Watch, but it wasn't clear if that was going to happen. It did end up happening, but the big, huge news was that it has FDA approval, which it's the first, Apple says, in a consumer over-the-counter product that can do ECG. There have been other products on the market, but they usually need to go through a doctor's thing. There's a competing product, a band, I think we've talked about on the MacCast that in the past that you could get for your Apple Watch Series 3 or even Series 2. I think it connects via Bluetooth, and it will do an ECG on the watch. But in order to enable access to the records, the first report needs to be cleared by a doctor. So Apple's is going to be able to go over the counter. You're going to be able to get the reports in real time right on your wrist with FDA approval. And that was a huge, big announcement. And I read in the following reports that Apple literally got the approval like the day before they were able to do the announcement. So that announcement, I think, almost didn't happen. It was like right up to the last minute. They had submitted, they were doing the review. And we're going to give you a little more details on, a little bit later on how that all happened. Fall detection was surprising. Also, the fact that the Apple Watch is thinner, we had kind of heard about that. I want to make one comment on that, though, and this is an interesting fact, and I hadn't realized this. I think I knew this had happened, but I hadn't thought about it in a while because it happened a long time ago. When Apple went from the Series 1 to the Series 2, they increased the thickness of the Apple Watch ever so slightly. And I'm trying to remember, I think they did that for extra battery life, I think, when they added the GPS. Oh, it was the GPS components. So either the GPS components or something caused Apple to have to make the watch a little bit thicker. And that's the size it's been since the Series 2. So now the Series 4 comes along. It is thinner than the Series 3. But guess what? It's still not back to its original launch weight, or launch thickness. It is still a little bit thicker than the Series 0 or the Series 1 used to be. So just an interesting little factoid. Again, the demos, I thought the software demos, cool, interesting. They tended to drag a little bit. The one that stood out was the basketball augmented reality demo, where you can set up the phone and take shots on a basket. It will detect where the basket is, and then it can capture and record things like release time, where you were standing on the court when you threw the ball, whether or not you made the basket or not, to help you analyze your basketball game. So it's designed for coaches and players, people who do basketball. And that was really impressive. And that's the kind of stuff that's being enabled by the neural engine and the stuff that Apple is doing on the phone. So I have to wonder, that app is coming out. It sounds like it's going to support a lot of different iPhones, but I'm curious if there's certain features of apps like that that are going to be exclusive to the new devices. Time will tell, and I couldn't find additional information on that, but I have the suspicion. So that was another reason why I kind of felt I needed to do the upgrade this time around. There was no mention at all, and this wasn't surprising because we've heard that Apple's been having a lot of problems with this, of the Air Power Mat. Apple pre-announced that over a year ago, and we still have not seen that product, and it sounds like we're not going to be seeing that product anytime soon. Apple certainly didn't mention it during the keynote. The other kind of thing that was a first impression coming out of the event, and kind of the last thing that we'll talk about, is increased pricing across the board on both the Series 4 Apple Watches and the iPhone XS. Max now topping out at almost $1,500 US, $1,449 for the 512 gigabyte model. So Apple pushing that pricing up. Apple Watch pricing starts $100 higher, $399 for the GPS model, $499 US for the cellular model. And so, you know, I have to wonder, the Apple Watch Series 3 is also staying in the lineup, but it is starting at $279, which I believe is a little bit of a price increase over the current Series 2 that it's replacing, which is that entry-level model of iPhone, or Apple Watch, rather. So across the board, prices are up just slightly, and I know that upsets some people. I have to wonder if a little bit of it isn't due to some of the tariff things that are going on here in the United States. I know Apple Watches, our prices went up across the board globally. That's what Apple tends to do when it increases its base prices for the U.S. is sort of like everybody gets a hit for that. But yeah, with the new tariffs, maybe Apple's trying to hedge their bets on that. I don't know. But, you know, it could just be Apple trying to make more money. You know, they are a company that wants to make profit, and they seem to be pretty good at it. And as you'll hear a little bit later when we talk about sales, it doesn't seem to be impacting the number of units they're selling. As a matter of fact, it's looking like iPhone and Apple Watch are going to be getting a little bump in their sales this year. The 512 gigabyte, that only other thing I want to comment on here, it wasn't surprising that Apple announced that again. I still wonder, you know, is that size, how many people need that size? It's seeming like a lot because a lot of people seem to be going for that model. Another thing though, on the pricing side of things is typically we're used to them going from the base model, each jump in storage going up about $100. Looking at the pricing this year, the leap from the 64 to the 256 gigabyte is actually $149. So there's an even bigger price jump across the models. And it's a pretty big jump, too, 64 to 256. I'm kind of wondering what happened to the 128 and why that didn't make it into the lineup. Apple typically does a jump like that, but that is a significant jump, right? So I think a lot of people are not going to go for the 64 just to save the $150, but maybe, I mean, that is a significant, maybe that's why they did the larger price jump, is to make people think more about, do I actually need this storage? You know, when it's $100 more, you're kind of like, oh, I can, you know, basically quadruple my storage for $100. Yeah, I'm going to go for that. But we'll have to see. It's looking again like, though, that the 512 models, at least in the early adoption phase, those seem to be the ones that a lot of people are going after. So that was kind of my first initial reactions to Apple's announcements. So let's dig a little bit deeper into some of this product stuff, and I'll tell you kind of some of the things that I've found out since the update, and again, share some additional thoughts just about the individual models and devices and things themselves. So let's start with that iPhone XS and the XS Max. A12 processor, serious update here. Again, it's one of the things that kind of pushed me to want to buy the phone. It's Apple's first 7-nanometer chip, which is a significant jump in terms of how they produce them. You've got 6 CPU cores, 2 performance cores, 4 efficiency cores. So that's the low power cores. A 4-core GPU, that's up, I think, from 2 cores in the prior generation, so 50% faster. But really, the big thing here is the neural engine. It is quadrupled the number of cores from 2 cores going all the way up to 8 cores this time around. And that's the thing that's really going to let this thing do a lot of the extra stuff that it can do and do things in real time. Plus, the entire thing is a system in a processor. You know, it's system on a chip kind of stuff. And you've got the digital image signal processor in there. You've got the depth engine. You've got all the video encoders and decoders. So this is in addition to the CPUs and the GPUs and the neural engine core, right? Got all these things going on in a single chip. You've got the secure enclave, all of the controllers, memory controllers. You've got the always-on processor for things like Ola Siri, all that stuff. So that is a really kind of pretty big deal. This is one of the bigger jumps, it feels to me, like in the A series line. It's one of the bigger jumps that we've had for a while. The iPhone XS Max, of course, being the large version of the phone. A lot of people have been waiting on this. An interesting thing about the size, though, is compared to the iPhone 8 Plus, Apple said it's the same size that's or about the same size. It's really just 0.4, so 4/10 of an inch, or hundredths rather, 4/100 of an inch shorter and 2/100 of an inch narrower. So not hugely significant difference in size. So if you're looking at an iPhone 8 Plus, you kind of get an idea of, you know, what that looks like. The iPhone XS, as I mentioned earlier, is exactly the same dimensions as the iPhone X, but it is 0.1 ounces lighter, so 1/10 of an ounce lighter. Apple says has faster Face ID. They didn't really quantify what that meant. So I, as you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Face ID. It's growing on me. It's gotten better in iOS 12. It's starting to work a little bit better for me, but I was very curious to know, are they going to upgrade or update Face ID? So when they said twice as fast, I thought, what does that mean? It's probably going to mean that it just doesn't recognize me faster. I kid. I'm kidding. It's a joke. We didn't really know. It actually has exactly the same sensors. So what's going on there is they're doing more stuff with the Neural Engine. I think that Phil kind of mentioned this stuff a little bit, but it wasn't really clear. Now it is. It is exactly the same true depth camera system as we had in the 10. So nothing changed there. So let's talk a little bit more about those camera systems. The new EyeSight, the front facing camera does have a 20% increase in the pixel depth of the sensor, 1.4 micrometers. That's up from 1.22. Yeah, I didn't know what that means either. What does that mean to you and I? It means it should have better low light sensitivity. So it's going to be a little bit enhanced, not anything significant. So if you have an iPhone 10, you know, this isn't a huge, massive change, but it is a small, slight technical difference. Beyond that, the camera system is identical, 12 megapixels. All the other specs remain the same. Apple did, again, though, with the camera system, really do some enhancements that are exclusive to the iPhone XS and XS Max with respect to that computational photography, doing stuff with the processors and the neural engine. So what you're going to get now is what Apple is calling smart HDR, where it's going to take 4 frames and then a bunch of inner frames and then some additional exposures and stuff like that to, and then process all that through the neural engine and the ISP chips and make your HDR images better. It also is what enables the, you know, those same processors is what's going to be enabling the new depth control system. What this allows you to do is adjust the aperture, basically what Apple calls bokeh, which I think technically isn't bokeh. Bokeh has to do more with the light that is in that sort of depth of field blur effect. It's really the depth of field that you're able to adjust. So you can take the aperture and adjust it after you've taken the photo, because again, it's all happening in software, from f1.4 to f16. And obviously, you're not really adjusting the aperture because you're not moving anything physical. But what it's doing is using the neural engine and the whole masking system and the depth of field data that it captured when you took the photo, and in real time processing all that through that processor. And that made for a really cool demo. At launch, this is only going to work in post-processing the photo after it's been taken, but they're saying with a software update this fall, they're actually going to enable a real-time preview feature, so you'll be able to pre-adjust and preset the aperture and depth of field before you take the photo. Obviously, you'll still be able to adjust it afterwards, but you know, some people like to kind of see what they're shooting right up front. I don't really know why. I guess so you don't have to go in and adjust it later, but just a little fact that came out this week as more and more info was coming out. Another thing on these phones, this line of phones that is new to just the iPhone XS and XS Max, faster LTE. They're going to support up to the gigabit LTE. The big technology that's enabling a lot of the faster speeds and even faster speeds on the current networks. So a lot of the gigabit stuff that's going to require your network to upgrade and stuff like that. But just overall, we're hearing that the phone should be faster. A company called Smart Speed Tests ran some tests on U.S. carriers. I think it was U.S. carriers exclusively, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon, with the new phones, and they show massive speed improvements in the LTE data. Download speeds going from 10 to 20 megabits per second on an iPhone 10 to between 60 to 72 megabits per second on the iPhone XS, XS Max. And that's because these now have a 4x4 multi-in, multi-out support in them, whereas the iPhone X had two by two multi-in, multi-out. And this has to do with some of the networking technologies. So a lot faster LTE. So if that's something that you care about, that might be a reason to upgrade from a 10 to a 10S, say. So if you want faster download speeds, faster mobile access for your data, and that's important to you, that is a significant increase. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that as people get their hands on the phones and are able to test them a little bit more on different networks. But right at the outset, it's looking to be a big improvement in LTE download speeds. All of them, all the new devices, including the new Apple Watch Series 4, have support for Bluetooth 5. So if that's important to you, that's another nice enhancement. And then another big thing that a lot of people were hoping for is the dual SIM support. This is important for people who travel, for people who maybe have to carry a phone for their office that's separate from their home phone or from their personal cell phone. You can now possibly combine those, because with dual SIM, you can have one work number and one home number. It's totally separate, but on the same device. Apple is achieving this, as they said in the keynote, by having one physical SIM in the device and one eSIM. That's true everywhere except for China, where I can't remember, there's some technical reasons or regulatory reasons, they actually have to have dual SIM cards. So you'll have two physical slots in a Chinese iPhone. But everywhere else, you get an eSIM, and that means that you can replace the SIM card while keeping the eSIM attached to your home carrier or your local carrier. So you can have that locked in, always, you know, your local one, and then when you travel, you can pop the SIM out or add a SIM into the SIM card slot and have a second local carrier. Or I guess you could go vice versa and have a physical SIM for your home carrier and then use the eSIM. Actually, that's probably more likely how that's going to happen, because Apple did mention being able to take the phone, point it at a QR code, and auto-config when you're in another country the eSIM. The technology that enables this is something called dual SIM, dual standby, or what Apple's using in the phone is going to use dual SIM, dual standby. And what that means is that it's going to allow your device to accept incoming calls on either number. You'll see what number it's coming in on, and you can just pick it up, and it's going to activate the SIM for the network or that phone number on the fly. So it's kind of always listening. It's there, ready to go, but you're not necessarily on that network, right? Because it's going to pop the SIMs back and forth. So it's doing this whole auto-switching thing, which is just kind of mind-blowing. I had never really thought about it too much. When people talked about dual SIMs, I thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. You got two SIMs, you got two carriers, it's sitting on two networks. It sounds like the way it works is more like it's kind of listening on both networks and then activating itself when it needs to be on the right network to pick that up. So very, very interesting. I don't know with dual SIMs. I don't think you're going to be able to mix carrier technologies, but maybe you can. Actually, it kind of supports, it is a world phone, so it kind of supports all the different carriers and the bands and stuff like that. So I guess technically maybe you could have an AT&T and a Verizon in the same device, which we've never really had before. I'm going to have to look into that a little bit deeper. If you happen to know, shoot us an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But I can't, now thinking about specs, think of any reason why that wouldn't work. And sorry I didn't do that research on that in advance. I literally just thought of that question now. It's not going to be enabled at launch, unfortunately, the dual SIM. They're going to activate it through a future iOS 12 software update, but they did not say when. couple other things just on the bands. It is going to be Apple's first handset to support the 600 megahertz spectrum band on T-Mobile in the U.S., which is something that iPhones haven't supported before. And actually, Apple kind of took some flack for not having support for that on the iPhone X. Also, the 2018 iPhones are going to support HPUE on the Sprint network. So again, this is all kind of that faster networking stuff. Just for comparison, though, the 4x4 multi-in, multi-out technology, that is exclusive to the iPhone XS, XS Max line. It is not part of the iPhone XR. So if you're comparing the models, and again, LTE performance is important to you, then that might be a reason to rule out the iPhone XR as a phone. But I am like super excited. We're going to talk about the XR in a second. Super excited. Last thing to kind of to finish up some of the unknown stuff about the iPhone XS line. Support for faster charging rates was mentioned. So a lot of people wondering, does that mean the iPhone is going to support, you know, 10 watt charging, up to 15 watt charging? No, Apple has made this improvement in terms of efficiency. This is something we heard in the rumors in the lead up to the event that Apple was going to be maybe changing the material used for the wireless charging coil to being pure copper, which would make it more efficient, build up less heat and that stuff. It does appear that they've done that. So you're still capped at the 7.5 watts, but it does charge a little bit quicker. And some of the testing, the early testing that we've seen so far, it's sounding like you'll get to a full charge on an iPhone XS model about 30 minutes faster than you would have with an iPhone X. So not a huge speed increase. The good news there, though, is that if you already have invested in 7.5 watt chargers, all your chargers are going to work exactly the same as they did with your iPhone 10 or 8 Plus or whatever wireless charging phone you currently have. So that's kind of good news there. And then one other cool little thing, this only impacts probably a few people, but the NFC chip and the phone itself has support for something called NFC Express cards. This is the ability to use your phone as like your bus pass or your transit card for the train, whatever it might be. If your train or bus system in your local area supports that sort of thing. Also, Apple had announced that you're going to be able to use your phone for your student ID cards on a lot of campuses. So this is all enabled with something called NFC Express card technology. And there is a feature in these new iPhones where even if you've let your iPhone run down during the day to the point where it has no power, where it's powered down, you know, turned itself off, you're still going to be able to, I guess, use those Express cards. So I think it's going to shut down with just a minuscule amount of power. So that means you can still get home. You can still unlock the door to your dorm room, something like that. A big, big safety feature here. This will not work, though, if you manually power down the phone. So if you press and hold and, you know, shut the phone down manually and really turn it off, it won't work. This only works if the phone has been on and then powered down itself. But that's good news if you're planning on using that technology for, again, your transit cards or your student ID. So let's talk a little bit more about the iPhone XR. I think this was probably, next to the Apple Watch Series 4, the biggest announcement that Apple made. You know, the XS, XS Max, that's great. They're nice enhancements. A lot of people really have been wanting the large version of an iPhone X, so you get it this year. But in many ways, it's not very different than the current iPhone X, other than the size. You know, materials are all the same, the form factor design, same cameras, all that stuff. We've gone through that. The XR takes the iPhone, what basically is the iPhone 8 Plus, and brings all the look and styling and features of the iPhone XS series into that, plus almost all of the internal components, right? It shares all the same processor, the GPU, the wide-angle EyeSight camera with all the same specifications, the same exact true-depth camera system as the XS models, and brings that all in at a much more affordable price. Of course, the big differences are the LCD, the fact that it's not got steel bands around the outside, it's actually got an aluminum band. It's a single lens camera system, not the dual lens camera system, and there's no 3D touch. Those are kind of the big differences, but let's get into some of the little more technical details and a few of the other minor differences. Waterproof rating, I forgot to mention the 10S models, that brings that up to IPX68, which means into 3 meters of water for up to 30 minutes. The iPhone XR shares the same IPX rating as the iPhone X. 10 did, IPX67, so that's 1 meter of water for up to 30 minutes. It does not, the iPhone XR doesn't offer the 512 gigabyte max storage. It maxes out at 256, so you get the, I think, 32, 128, and 256 are the size options. Oh, no, it's 64, 128, and 256. The display is an IPS display, so it is an LCD, but it is an improved LCD. Apple's calling it their liquid retina display. Again, back with the weird marketing stuff. Who knows what that means? I don't know why it's called liquid. There's not water in there. It's got the same pixel density as older retina LCD displays on the iPhone, 326 pixels per inch. That's versus the 458 pixels per inch that is in the 10S model OLED screens. But still, it is a great IPS display. It has true tone support. It has the wide color gamut, the P3 gamut. So it's going to look great. Apple makes quality LCDs, and a lot of the first-hand reviews have said it is a brilliant display. It will be hard, I think, for most people to tell the difference. Yes, people like us who are technical and into these sorts of things, you know that OLEDs or the OLED displays have a much deeper contrast ratio, you know, deeper blacks, richer, all those sorts of things. But I think the average person is going to be hard-pressed to tell the difference. The resolution is 1792 by 828. Some people are unhappy that that is not a true 10, it doesn't afford the ability to do a true 1080p HD resolution. I don't see that as a big issue. Again, I personally am going to reserve judgment until October when I can get into an Apple store and actually look at these things. I think it's going to look great. I'm super excited about the iPhone XR. I even really seriously considered that as the model to upgrade to, but again, because I didn't want to wait, because a lot of the features are the same that I'm going to be, things that I'm going to be getting asked about, and I already have an iPhone 10. I've kind of gotten used to the dual lens camera system. I don't use the telephoto all that frequently, to be honest with you, but I have a feeling I would miss it when I didn't have it, since I've already had it. So going backwards there, I kind of hesitated on that, although I was super excited about the colors. The colors look great on the iPhone XR, and the ability to have a different color. I really liked the yellow and the blue. The red looks great as well. I just was like, oh, I almost want to buy that. I wish I could get the XS in those colors. But again, camera system, the EyeSight, it is a single lens system. It has just the wide angle, but it is exactly the same lens system, the same camera as the iPhone XS for that one camera. It does do the smart HDR. It does the depth control stuff because it has the same processor, the neural engine. It doesn't have the telephoto. It doesn't have the optical zoom. It only has a 5X digital. But I think for most people, that's not really going to matter. And again, this phone is base priced $250 less than the iPhone XS. And it is every bit as much technically the same phone in so many ways. And one way, it's even better than both the XS and the XS Max. It has a longer battery life, just slightly, about an hour in most places. But if battery life is your main thing, and reports have said that most consumers, that's the number one thing they want, is longer battery life, then I think because of the LCD display, actually the LCD display should take up more power than the OLED. So I don't know. It's just a bigger phone. It has a big battery. It is about the same size. It sits between the iPhone XS and XS Max in terms of the physical side, but I think it's more toward that plus size. It is a large phone. So if you don't like large phones, factor that into your consideration, because the physical dimensions are pretty big. And yes, it has wireless charging. A lot of people wanted to know because Apple didn't specifically call that out. But yeah, it has the full wireless charging, Qi wireless charging, just the same as all of the other phones. Comes in 64 gigabyte, 128, and 256 gigabytes, starting at $749. I think I might have said $799 earlier. Sorry about that. But here, the jump, and again, weird things on the pricing, the jump from 64 gigabytes to 128, it's only $50. So $749 for the 64 gig, $799 for the 128, and then $899, the standard $100 price jump for the 256. So Apple playing around with the pricing, although do note that the base price has, in general, gone up. It's $50 more than the iPhone 8, but $50 less than the 8 Plus was. And technically, this is kind of the replacement for the iPhone 8 Plus. I really think, though, more it's the replacement for what would have been the iPhone 10 repriced, right? Anyway, I think it's a killer deal. Like, if you're looking for, you know, the latest and greatest phone and you want the best price, this has it all. And I'm not surprised that many of you are excited about this. I've heard a lot of people say, you know what, I am skipping the iPhone 10, 10S, or 10S, 10S Max. I'm going to be waiting for the 10R, and that's going to be my upgrade. So that was the iPhone announcements. The other big announcement, of course, was the Apple Watch Series 4. A few other things coming, details coming out since Apple made the keynote. Some of these you may have heard, some were covered in the keynote. Dual core processor, 64-bit, double the performance, which that's a big complaint I get, especially from people who have older Apple Watches, you know, and even my Series 2. I've noticed with watchOS 5, even before watchOS 5, launching apps, it's okay, but it's kind of slow. You're waiting 15, 20 seconds sometime for an app to spin up. So if that can be improved, that is a pretty big deal. Of course, the really huge deal is the electrical and optical heart rate sensor. So there's actually electrical contacts both on the back of the watch and one built into the new Taptic digital crown. So the crown is solid state. It still spins and you'll get some haptic feedback in terms of like little clicks. But the end of it has a little sensor on it to enable that FDA approved heart rate sensor that can do ECGs. The FDA data that helped Apple push over and get that approval and get the clearance from the FDA came from Apple's heart rate study. So they had been doing that since November. It was in conjunction with Stanford Health, and it actually wrapped up at the beginning of this month. So that data supposedly was enough to convince the FDA that Apple's heart rate technology and the sensor technology is good enough to help win those approvals. It was part of it. Of course, they had to submit a bunch of other tests and data and things like that, and they won that approval, and that is a big deal. So you've got that haptic digital crown. It's an extra touch point for the ECG. A few other features in the new heart rate sensor, and actually, I think you can get this in watchOS for some of the other watches, too, is you can get low heart rate detection and also atrial fibrillation detection. I have a hard time saying that word. Fibrillation. I don't know why that's so difficult for me to say, but anyway, you know what I mean. It'll detect irregular heart rates. The back of the Apple Watch Series 4 is all ceramic and sapphire crystal. That makes it radio transparent, so it should have better reception. One thing I did wonder about that is your body can block cellular signals. Remember that was the whole antenna gate, you're holding it wrong thing. So if the back of that is right against your wrist, I guess it would kind of come out the sides on the back and maybe radio waves get in there a little bit more easily. But Apple's saying you're going to get better reception, cellular reception with the Series 4 watch. And then several of the new faces, but not all of them. A big question I got after this, because Apple showed off a bunch of really cool new watch faces in the keynote. Hey, are these going to work on my older Apple Watch? Will they be supported on my Series 2 or Series 3? In watchOS 5, they are in there, a few of them. The Fire, Vapor, Water, Liquid Metal, and Breathe watch faces are all available and will work The one huge difference, though, between them on older watches versus the Series 4 Apple Watch is on the Series 4, the animations and the images go edge to edge, all the way out to the corners of the displays. On older models, you get a just circle. It's kind of masked and restricted to just the center of the watch. The other thing you're not going to get on older watches are those new, really cool, informationally dense, what Apple calls infograph watches, or watch faces, the one that'll do 8 complications in one watch. So there's the infograph and the infograph modular, which is an update to the modular face exclusively for the Apple Watch Series 4. So if you want those watch faces, you're going to be buying a new Apple Watch. That's kind of an expensive proposition to get for new new watch faces. So hopefully you're buying it for more of the health reasons, the ECG and that sort of stuff, the bigger screen. And one thing that, Apple called it an edge-to-edge display. In looking at the demo photos, I need to see one in person. And all of the reviewers said it's an edge-to-edge display. It's got more display on the screen. As a matter of fact, the smaller display, the one on the 40 millimeter display, is supposedly larger than the current 42 millimeter Apple Watch display in terms of what can fit on the screen, the size of the screen. But it still seemed to me like it had a pretty hefty bezel around the watch. You know, between the casing and the actual display, there's still a pretty good bezel around there. So I don't know, maybe that's why it's a little bit bigger, 40 millimeters and 44 millimeters versus 38 and 42. But they are available to order now, and they are shipping this Friday. And I know many of you have pre-ordered them. I did not pre-order one. Again, it's kind of a cash money thing. It's a lot of money to spend all up front, and I'm super happy with my Series 2 Apple Watch. If I come into some extra cash around the holidays, which can happen sometimes, gifts and things like that, I may upgrade. I am very, very tempted by the Apple Watch Series 4. A few other odds and ends coming out since the announcements. Just overall, Ming-Chi Kuo, he thinks the iPhones and Apple Watch are going to sell very well. I think that's not too surprising. He expects iPhone shipments to grow slightly year on year, with Apple selling between 75 and 80 million units. He did comment on the pre-orders of the iPhone XS, specifically saying they were, quote, lower than expected. And he thinks that the iPhone XS might only account for about 10 to 15% of new 2018 iPhone shipments. The big winners and the phone that most people are going to be ordering is probably going to be the XR, the slightly more affordable XR, and a lot of people going for the XS Max. And I think that, again, the main reason for that is because Apple didn't have a plus size version of the X last year. So this is kind of like the first year for the redesigned large iPhone model. And I know a lot of you are going for that one. Seems to be very, very popular at this point. He said the Apple Watch Series 4 will sell better than expected because of the innovative new features. Really, specifically referring to the ECG stuff. He thinks that Apple could reach 18 million units in 2018 for the Apple Watch. And it is key here to remember, he's talking about just year-on-year sales going up slightly, but everything this year in terms of the new models of watch and phone are more expensive. Some more, bigger price increases than others, but even modest growth in the iPhone lineup or Apple Watch sales, it's going to have a much bigger impact on revenue. So I fully expect Apple's revenue numbers to be through the roof after the holiday season. I think it's going to be a very, very good last quarter of the year for Apple. I think they call that their first fiscal quarter, and they'll report those numbers sometime at the beginning of next year. So look for those numbers to be really, really big. There was a little tweak to AppleCare. You may have noticed this when you checked out. AppleCare Plus now has an additional option. You can add on theft and loss coverage. It adds $100 to the base price of AppleCare. So rather than being $199, it's going to increase the price to $299 for your iPhone X, XS, XR, and all that stuff. It does include, as always, two incidents of damage, accidental damage, that will be covered. If it's a screen replacement, for $29 deductible, any other damage is going to cost you $99. If you add on that theft and loss coverage, then it requires you to have Find My iPhone enabled on your device at the time it was lost or stolen. And during the theft or loss claim process, you are going to be asked to erase your missing device, to disable it and transfer the ownership of it, I'm assuming to the insurance company or Apple, before you're issued a new device. I would assume that's so, you know, to cut down on fraud claims, and also in case the device is actually recovered, it can go back to the insurance company because you're going to get your phone replaced. The deductibles or replacement costs vary dependent upon which iPhone model you have the coverage on. So if you have an 8, a 7, or a 6S, it's $199 deductible, $299 for an iPhone XR, iPhone 8 Plus, iPhone 7 Plus, or an iPhone 6S Plus, and $269, of course, all of these are in US dollars, for an iPhone XS, XS Max, or an iPhone X. And another change to AppleCare Plus is you can choose to pay all at once now, or you can make monthly payments on your AppleCare Plus. And of course, if you're on the upgrade program, Apple requires you to get AppleCare Plus. If you want to add the theft protection, it adds about $4 to the monthly base cost if you're on the Apple upgrade program. So I chose to add it on to mine. Because it didn't seem like that big of an increase. And yeah, if something happens and I need to replace my device, then I'm going to want to be able to do that and not have to pay full replacement cost. Although looking at that $269 price, I have to imagine that's pretty close to the out-of-warranty replacement cost. Of course, if you have your phone stolen, they're not going to replace it because you don't have anything to turn in. So might be something worth thinking about. I think it's a nice little addition to AppleCare Plus. Battery repairs for the iPhone X, iPhone XS, and iPhone XS Max will be going back to their normal pricing. Also, older iPhones. So remember, right now, until the end of the year, Apple is offering $29 battery replacements on iPhones, or most iPhone models. That ends at the end of the year. After that, the X, XS, and XS Max are going to cost you $69 for a new battery. That's down from $79 before the $29 replacement program went into effect. If you have an older iPhone, all older models other than the X, XS, and XS Max, the battery replacement is going to cost just $49. So Apple giving us a break on battery repairs. So we talked about everything that has sort of come out, was added, and what's in the phones. What we haven't talked about yet is what didn't happen at the event, or what things went away. So a couple of iPhone models that are going to be that are now no longer available for sale, much to the to the chagrin of 4-inch iPhone fans across the board. The iPhone SE is no longer being sold. It didn't get an update. We are not expecting it to get an update. It seems like Apple has fully abandoned at this point the 4-inch form factor. Unless they surprise us, they always still could. But that model is gone. Of course, they're not selling the iPhone X anymore, but that was expected. And the iPhone 6S is no longer in the lineup. So the new base model iPhone is the iPhone 7, and it costs $100 more than the $349 iPhone SE that it replaced. So starting at $449 for an iPhone 7. Apple did keep the iPhone 7 and 8 models in the lineup. So you have 7, 7 Plus, 8, 8 Plus. Then you have the iPhone XR, iPhone XS, XS Plus, XS and XS Max, and that rounds out the full lineup of iPhones. In the box with the new iPhones, it was thought that you might get a new fast charging power adapter, maybe up to 18 watts USB-C. That's not happening. It is the standard 5-watt power adapter that Apple has been including for years. They are going to include the Lightning EarPods, but you are not anymore going to get the 3.5 millimeter Lightning adapter. So if you have older headphones that you want to use with your Apple Watch and you need an adapter and you don't have one already, or with an iPhone rather, I said Apple Watch, you're going to have to pony up for that. You're going to have to buy one from the Apple store. So just be aware of that if you're ordering a new device and you want to use your own 3.5 millimeter headphones. Otherwise, you know, get a set of AirPods if you can. I highly recommend them. I absolutely love mine. We already commented on AirPower, but I want to go into a little bit more detail. Apple didn't talk about it, and a lot of people were wondering what was going on. Right after the event, Apple seemed to scrub almost every mention of it from their website. They didn't talk about it. And all reports are saying it has been severely delayed and has a very good possibility of dying on the vine. It may turn out to be complete vaporware, folks, at this point. Info came out in a report from Sonny Dixon, infamous Apple leaker, or famous Apple leaker, I guess we can say at this point, Sonny Dixon. He's gotten some things right in the past. He posted a little thing on his blog. He says his sources say that the project might be, quote, doomed to failure. I think that was kind of obvious at this point, wasn't it? The fact that it's been over a year since they pre-announced it and we haven't seen hide nor hair of it. Yeah. Supposedly what's going on is heat management. And if you talked to anybody who was any kind of an engineer, especially like an electrical engineer or something like that, when Apple made the announcement, many of you electrical engineers or engineers have told me there's no way that thing can work. It's never going to work. So I don't know who sold Apple the bill of goods that it might work. But yeah, heat management is reported to be one of the biggest issues. The coils heat up. Actually, heat management is an issue in any wireless charging puck, even the single coil ones that we have now. They also say there's buggy inner device communication. So, you know, the talking, since you have multiple devices on there, the management of that stuff. And you're getting mechanical and interference issues. The report claims that there are between 21 and 24 various sized coils in this thing, and they're broken down into three distinct charging groups. I would assume one for each device area, right? You can put three devices on there at the same time. You've got all these little overlapping coils, and those are interfering with each other. They're generating heat, and Apple wants all this stuff in this compact design. They showed off the design. They're unwilling to compromise on it, and it is causing all kinds of headaches and problems. You know, physics is physics, folks. You know, there's only so many rules you can bend, despite how big your reality distortion field might be. And I have a feeling it's sounding like we're running up against the laws of physics here. And Apple, you know, as influential and powerful as they can be, they can't change the laws of physics. So we'll have to see what happens. I'm guessing the thing either dies or the thing that actually ships and comes out looks nothing like the thing that we saw or we have seen so far, but we'll have to see. It's kind of disappointing because it looked like a cool product. But even when it comes out, it's going to be super expensive. If it comes out, it's going to be super expensive. I'm telling you right now, just based on all these things. And I just don't get it, because you can get three individual pucks, you know, for probably about $10 a piece and go on your merry way. So I've never quite understood the appeal of the AirPower. And I have a feeling Apple's just sort of sweeping it under the rug at this point, hoping that it goes away and we just all sort of forget about it by not mentioning it ever again. The Apple Watch did lose one of its models, the Apple Watch Edition, the ceramic $1,500 version. So there is no premium, what do they call that? The edition version of the Apple Watch is not available. And those are kind of all the major things that didn't happen or went away. Of course, you know, the other thing we talked about at the top, Apple didn't talk about any new Macs or iPads, but we're fully expecting a new event, another event in October where all of that will happen. I guess the last thing to talk about here is maybe what will be next or what will not. Ming-Chi Kuo again says in 2019, Apple will not bring the time of flight depth system to the EyeSight camera. This was something we heard rumored about almost a year ago. It was expected Apple might add this technology into this year's iPhones. And the reason Kuo cites for this is he says the current technology is good enough and has all the features that customers want. Apple, the idea behind the time of flight system was there was going to be a laser sensor array within the EyeSight camera that would sort of shoot out light and bounce it back and read it and be able to do depth of field and all this fancy stuff. They're doing a lot of that stuff already, as exemplified by the iPhone XR having portrait mode features with a single lens camera system. So with the Neural Engine, with all that computational stuff, they're able to get depth readings with the current lens system. And I guess that's good enough for all the things they want to do and for the features that customers want. So they're feeling like they don't have to do that. And that's what Ming-Chi Kuo's responding to here. So it's sounding like Apple's not going to do that. And Apple's, you know, augmented reality glasses and advanced AR experiences for maps and things like that, those might not be ready to launch next year. So it's looking like they're not going to need the time of flight system for that technology either. So there's been these rumors that, you know, the iPhone could become part of an augmented reality system, an AR glasses system that Apple's working on. And so they're not going to have to do that. And also they're delaying that a little bit because the augmented reality ecosystem requires the 5G connectivity, and that's not ubiquitous yet. Apple doesn't have its AR glasses project, you know, head-mountable thing out and ready yet. And they're also working on a more powerful Apple Maps database that's going to have distance and depth information and stuff like that. So that's taking longer to build out. So for all of these reasons, it's looking like we're not going to get that enhancement to the EyeSight camera next year. So it'll be interesting to see what they do, but we don't really know at this point. But with that, that's kind of wraps up everything that I know to this point with respect to Apple's new products, the iPhone XS, XS Max, XR, and the Apple Watch Series 4. So the other thing, big thing that happened on Monday, just a day ago as I record the podcast, is the release version of iOS 12 and watchOS 5 came out, along with updates to tvOS and HomePod. I thought we'd real quickly go through some of the improvements and enhancements there. iOS 12, one of the big things, and another reason why you might not have to upgrade to a new iPhone this year, is performance improvements. And I'm already hearing from a lot of people who have older devices like an iPhone 6S or 7, that your devices are performing better under iOS 12. And a few of you have even commented to say, yeah, I think I'm going to be able to stick with my current device because of the performance increases with iOS 12. So that's really great news. After the whole debacle with, you know, Apple and quote-unquote Throttlegate, I hate that name, but that's what it's called, and when I say that, you know what that means, so it's the easiest way to present it to you. But yeah, all of that is behind us now. It is over, and iOS 12 brings performance improvements to older devices. Another cool feature inside iOS 12 that I'm really enjoying, screen time, the ability to go in and see what apps I'm spending the most time in on my devices and monitor my family's devices, especially my kids' devices, and make sure they're not spending too much time on social media or doing things they shouldn't be, being able to control and set times and block individual types of apps or categories of apps at specific times is kind of nice. I don't know how much of it I'm going to be using. We handle a lot of that stuff just in different ways through, you know, conversations and just kind of general parenting stuff. But if those are tools that can help you, I think they're great. I absolutely love them. And screen time has been really, really neat to play around with. Siri shortcuts, I think it's going to take me a while to figure out how revolutionary this is going to be. There's some great stuff in there. Siri shortcuts and just the shortcuts app in general, which is really an update to Workflow. You do have to download it as a separate app. So if you've never installed or used Workflow, you are going to have to download the shortcuts app. But this allows you to automate various things on your iOS devices, and it has third-party app support, so a lot of third-party apps are starting to integrate into the shortcuts and the Siri shortcuts. So a ton of your favorite apps are getting updated right now. I have a feeling it's kind of like a lot of these new features where everybody sort of jumps in. Think of ARKit, right? A bunch of apps suddenly got ARKit support, whether or not they should have had them or not, right? A lot of it wasn't very useful. I think we're going to see that with shortcuts too. I think there's going to be a lot of apps that integrate with shortcuts and Siri shortcuts that's like, I don't really need a Siri shortcut for that. Others are going to be hugely beneficial. And so I'm still trying to figure all this stuff out. Luckily, Apple has a pretty good how-to tutorial on their support website. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. So they have a little guide that has a bunch of little chapters that shows you how to get into and start up with shortcuts and Siri shortcuts, but even better, our friend David Sparks, Mac Sparky, has a new field guide course that you can sign up for. You can go to learn.macsparky.com. And he's got a bunch of videos and tutorials. It is a paid service, but you can buy, I think it's $24, and you can buy the full course. And he does a great job teaching that stuff. So if you want to learn about shortcuts, there's lots of stuff becoming available. I'm going to play around with it. We'll try and share some tips and tricks on future episodes of the MacCast, but I'm going to have to dig in for a little bit before I even really fully understand it. I've played around, and I have a few useful things that I've worked out with it, but I want to get much deeper before we have a big conversation. But if you do have some tips and tricks or something you learned you want to share, shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. If you have a device with a true-depth camera system, of course, iOS 12 brings Memoji support in addition to additional Animojis. You get the Measure app, which uses ARKit, although early reports are saying it's not really 100% accurate. You know, like, I would not build my house around measurements from the Measure app. It gets close, but maybe not 100% accurate. So just be aware of that. So those are kind of some of the big new features in iOS 12. Of course, there's a bunch of other little enhancements and stuff like that. Some of the lesser known stuff that I thought was pretty cool that I started reading about. The trackpad mode, which used to be something exclusive to phones that had 3D touch, that's coming to older devices because now you can tap and hold on the space bar and get into trackpad mode on the keyboard. And what trackpad mode is that gives you the ability to move the cursor around on the screen like using your display as a trackpad. So you press and just tap and hold on the space bar, and that'll put you into the trackpad mode. It's pretty cool to play around with. And if you want to select, with Force Touch, you can press a little bit harder and make selections. With the iPhone that doesn't have 3D touch, if you just tap with a second finger while you're using trackpad mode, you can do a selection. Face ID is adding support for alternate faces. So if you want to have two people in your Face ID database, or if you just change your look frequently enough where maybe, you know, you grow a beard in the winter and you shave it off in the summer, you can record, you know, face detection for both those looks, those appearances, and it should be able to recognize them more readily. Of course, if you do that gradually over time, it'll adapt to that. But, you know, if it's an extreme change in appearance, you might want to record alternate Face ID appearance. So you can go in there. There's some new Do Not Disturb options. This is pretty cool. You can now have timed Do Not Disturb. So if you know, hey, I'm going into a meeting for an hour, you can turn on Do Not Disturb and set it to turn off automatically in an hour. Or location-based. So you can say, you know, when I leave this location, go ahead and turn Do Not Disturb off. Or you can, of course, make it permanent and leave it on all the time. So I love Do Not Disturb. I use it quite frequently, especially if I'm wanting to be face-to-face with somebody, I have a meeting, I'm just going somewhere where I don't want my phone bothering me. Another nice little enhancement to notifications that can help with that is you can now have quiet specific notifications, rather. So on the notification screen, if you're being overloaded by an app or something like that, you can swipe across that from the left, I think, or swipe left on that and go all the way, and you'll see a manage option. And if you tap on manage, you can say deliver quietly. And when you do that, the notification won't come up on your screen, but it'll still be there in notifications when you swipe up to review it. So you can do that. And then to turn it off, you can switch it back to deliver prominently. So swiping up on the lock screen will then give you access to the quieted notifications. So I have a feeling that's a feature I'll be using quite frequently too. Live listening. This is kind of a cool thing. If you have trouble hearing in loud environments or something like that, and you have AirPods or headphones or something like that, you can turn your iPhone into an enhanced listening device. So you could add a new icon to your control center, a little hearing icon, and when you tap that, anything that comes through your iPhone's microphone will be transmitted to a set of headphones. It's like having kind of a little hearing aid. So to enable this, go into settings on your iPhone in iOS 12, into the control center settings, and then click on or tap on customize and add the hearing option. And then when you go into control center and tap hearing, it will enable this new live listening mode. Here's a cool little iOS 12 enhancement. If you use two-factor authentication on services that SMS or text you the code, Apple Messages app will now watch for those one-time SMS password codes and automatically copy them and paste them into your login for you. So there's a lot of login enhancements. Of course, there's the new password autofill feature that has support for third-party apps like 1Password. You do have to turn that on. So if you use a manager like LastPass or 1Password that has an iOS app, you go into Settings, Passwords and Accounts, and tap on Autofill Passwords, and then you need to check on and enable the apps that you want to have access to that feature. And then another thing people are really looking forward to is fave icons in Safari tabs. So if you want to have the fave icons, you got to turn those on. That's in Settings, Safari, Show Icons in Tabs. WatchOS 5 also has been released. We talked earlier about the new faces, and those are supported on many of the older watches, with the exception of those infograph faces. The new walkie-talkie feature, where you can directly connect to Apple Watches and talk like a set of walkie-talkies. I have not had a chance to try this feature out yet. I'm the only one in my family with an Apple Watch at this point. Might be another reason to buy a new Apple Watch, right? Just so I can use the walkie-talkie feature. That's probably not a good reason, but it's a reason I want to buy one. I hope to try that out. It looks pretty cool. If you have had a chance to play around with that, shoot us some feedback. Let us know what you think about that. I think it looks pretty cool. Huge one for a lot of people, the podcast app. And I have tried out the podcast app. You can now stream podcasts. You can subscribe to podcasts, listen to podcasts, all right there on your Apple Watch. You can also download and sync podcasts. So obviously, you would need either cellular or be needing to connect via Wi-Fi to use those features, or be connected to Wi-Fi to use those features. Raise to Speak, if you have an Apple Watch Series 3 or later, you can now set up Safari so you don't have to use, or Safari, you can now set up Siri, rather, so you don't have to use the Hey Lady command to activate and issue commands to Siri. You can use Always On Listening to enable that. You open up the Settings app on the Apple Watch. I don't know if there's a way to do it from the watch application itself, but on the watch itself, if you go into the Settings app, choose General, scroll down to Siri, and then toggle on the Raise to Speak option, you can enable it. Another feature that I am finding hugely helpful, because I run into this problem all the time now that I've started walking more frequently. I'm doing outdoor walks, trying to get some more exercise, and I am pretty good about starting the walk workout, but I often forget to turn it off. I've had situations where I've been on a walk workout for 8 hours. No, not really. I don't walk that long, only because I forgot to stop the workout. And so there is now auto start and auto stop detection in the Apple Watch. So even one day I forgot to start the workout. About halfway through my walk, I looked down at my wrist to check my progress, and it said, "Hey, it looks like you've started an outdoor walk. Do you want to record this?" And I tapped yes, and actually it had captured my entire walk without me having to actually start the workout. And now it also reminds me, if I get home and I get busy, I forgot to stop the workout, it says, "Hey, it looks like you've stopped working out. Do you want to stop it?" And it seems to be pretty accurate in terms of figuring that stuff out. And I think it uses your heart rate and your movement and all those sorts of things to figure that stuff out. But great new feature, probably my favorite new feature in WatchOS 5. And WatchOS 5 supports all Apple Watches Series 1 and later. Unfortunately, if you have a Series 0, it is the first watch not to support the new version of the operating system. In addition to iOS 12 and WatchOS 5, Apple also released tvOS 12. Probably the biggest update there is Dolby Atmos support for Apple TV 4K. So if you have an Apple TV 4K, it's the first set-top device, I think, to support both Dolby Atmos for sound, and Dolby Vision for the HDR. It also includes, tvOS also includes the new aerial screensavers from NASA. They look gorgeous. And probably the most useful feature is the password autofill using the TV remote app. So you can get it to autofill your passwords. That works with Face ID and Touch ID. Makes it really, really convenient for logging into stuff. I think it also added more support for single sign-on for additional carriers as well. So that's available through the tvOS update. And then also the updates to HomePod are out. You install those through the Home app. So if you have a HomePod, go into your Home app on your iOS device to get the HomePod updates. Big features here, finally support for multiple timers. I don't know why that wasn't there from day one. I'd be curious to hear the backstory on that someday. Hopefully we hear that from someone at Apple. They added calendar support, also something that I feel should have been there on day one, and the ability to make and receive phone calls. So you don't have to start the call on your phone now and then transfer it to the HomePod. You can actually make and receive phone calls right from the HomePod itself. So those updates are also available now, and you can grab them. And that is kind of the latest with software updates in the iOS ecosystem. Finally, finishing up the news for this week, a couple vulnerabilities and security issues to be aware of. Probably the first one is the bigger of the two. I'm not so sure how concerned people need to be. This was something that was discovered by researchers at F-Secure. The big deal here is this affects almost all Macs and Windows computers, even if they're using encryption, whole disk encryption like File Vault. It's a firmware exploit that actually exploits how your machine overwrites data in the memory when it's turned off. And it's called a cold boot vulnerability. The one thing to know about this is the attacker would need to have physical access to your device. So this would be if your device is actually stolen. But in almost all instances, it's possible to get data off of your Mac, even if you have File Vault encryption turned on, using this exploit. So I think it's, you know, somewhat hard to pull off. You need to be able to get access to the machine. But the company that discovered it, the researchers at F-Secure, did share their findings with Apple, Microsoft, and Intel. Apple, for their part, is looking into ways to protect their system from this vulnerability. They haven't released any updates yet, but I expect them to do if they can. I guess that would be the concern, is can they really do this? If you have a newer Mac, an iMac Pro or the latest 2018 MacBook Pro models with the T2 security chip in them, those are immune from this vulnerability. So T2 solves this problem. And I fully expect that all new Apple machines going forward are going to use the security chip. I have a feeling these kinds of exploits are a big reason why Apple developed that chip and those technologies, is to prevent this sort of thing. So again, I don't think this is a cause for huge concern. You should definitely continue to use File Vault encryption. I think it's a great thing if you're concerned, especially about protecting your data. Just know that, I mean, there is an exploit out there that could potentially get into it. I don't think it's going to be widespread and rampant problem, but, you know, depending upon your situation, this may be a concern. But for most of us, I don't see this as a huge problem, but it was a vulnerability that was disclosed and discovered this week. A separate iOS issue was also disclosed by a researcher on Twitter. This one is kind of like a memory overflow kind of bug that can cause your device, or more specifically, or I guess it's the whole device, your device to lock up and actually crash to kernel panic. It uses a bunch of CSS and HTML code, and I guess that's the somewhat concerning thing about this, is it's relatively easy to cause this to happen. What someone could do with this other than just be annoying, I'm not really sure. But basically what it does is sets up a ton crud of div tags on an HTML page and then uses the CSS background blur effect applied to every single one of those elements on the page. So it just becomes computationally intensive to WebKit. The processes to the WebKit browser cause a kernel panic to happen. It basically just gets overloaded and everything crashes and locks up. And it is a hard reset or a hard crash of your system. It's not just a springboard crash. So it's pretty annoying. You'd actually have to visit a website that had the code on it, or a website that was hacked or exploited and had this code put onto it. I'm not sure if it would work inside the embedded browser. Inside an app, you know, you have the ability in an app to pull up and create a browser. So I would imagine those things are affected as well. Another potential attack vector for this could be email, like HTML-based email. So if some nefarious person sent you an email, yeah, that could also potentially crash your iOS device. But again, aside from just crashing the device, I'm not really sure what other potential issues are involved here. So really just kind of a piece of annoying where is that a term? Is that something we can call that? But another little exploit, and I'm sure Apple will patch or figure out a way to address that pretty quickly. So I would expect that in a future Safari update. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, Jamf Now. They make it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. You know, it's pretty easy to keep track of your own stuff, your Mac, your iPhone, your iPad. But what if you have to manage and keep track of a suite of Apple devices, a bunch of Apple devices, maybe at work, maybe you have a small business with employees. And as you're growing, you're adding more and more digital inventory. You're assigning Macs and iPads and iPhones to your workers, and that makes it exponentially harder to manage all of the devices and data. And it's especially true if you are running a remote office, which is more and more common these days. So maybe you don't even all work in the same place, but you're giving out devices and systems to people. Well, with Jamf Now, you can check on your digital inventory. You can distribute Wi-Fi and email settings to all of those devices at once. You can deploy apps. You can protect your company data, even lock down or wipe devices as needed from anywhere. So if something gets lost or stolen, you can protect your valuable business data. And Jamf Now manages all your devices, helps you do that, so you can focus on your business instead, right? You don't want to be an IT expert, and you don't have to be with Jamf Now. There's actually no IT experience needed. Best of all, MacCast listeners, you can start securing your business today, setting up your first 3 devices for free, and that's for forever. And if you want to add additional devices, it's just $2 per month per device. So you can create your free account at jamf.com/MacCast. That's jamf.com/MacCast. Head there and you can set up your first 3 devices for free. And again, just $2 per month per device for additional devices. Huge, huge thank you to Jamf Now for their support of the MacCast. Earlier, I kind of shared my experiences in ordering the new iPhone and just my thoughts and opinions on Apple's product announcements. I've also heard from a number of you, a number of people in the community who wrote or called in to share their thoughts on Apple devices. Comments like this one from Martin, and I think he also has a couple of questions in here. So here's what Martin had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Martin in Virginia, a longtime listener. I thought I'd share my experience purchasing the iPhone XS Max yesterday. Since I'm on the East Coast, I had to go through the ritual of getting up at 3 in the morning and got through all the process pretty fast, and everything looked great. I was going to be able to get the phone on the 21st, and about 4 hours later, I got a text message on my phone that the fraud department of my credit card company had called, and so, of course, they declined the sale, and I was all panicked. But it turns out that Apple does try several times, and I'd gotten a hold of the fraud department and told them to release it, and all's well that ends well. You also wanted to know what uses all the battery power for the phones and why that's such a big issue. I'm on the road quite a lot, and I use Waze, and even though I have Wi-Fi turned off, with the constant GPS and everything else that it uses and listening to podcasts, it can suck through a full battery in less than a day, so I use a battery pack to help with that. And my question for you, I've been backing up just to my iMac, and the last time I went through this upgrade last year, the iOS got changed at the same time as the new phone, and I had a hard time transferring my backup to the new phone since it had a different iOS, and I had to upgrade the old phone to the new iOS before I could do the transfer. And I was wondering if I back up to the iCloud, if that would eliminate this problem, and can you do both backup to the iCloud and to the iMac? Thanks for all your great work, and I'll hear you soon. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Martin. Thanks for the questions and the comments and stuff like that. I'm going to take these things in reverse order because I think that's going to be a little bit easier for me. So starting with your question, yeah, absolutely, you can back up to both iCloud and iTunes. Actually, that's actually what I do when I upgrade typically, although last time around, I just did the over-the-air with iCloud, and it was seamless and easy and awesome. So I would definitely recommend that to anybody who wants to. But it's also great just to have a local backup. I also choose to encrypt it so that it backs up all my settings and stuff like that through iTunes. And it's just kind of like an extra backup, just good peace of mind in case anything goes wrong. It's weird, though, that you should be able to restore. I think you should be able to restore a backup from an older version of iOS to a newer version of iOS. And I do know one thing that occasionally happens, depending upon when you purchased your phone. Like, I don't know when you bought your new phone. If it was day one, I wouldn't think you would have this problem. But, you know, Apple just released iOS 12 to the public, right, yesterday, to Monday. So the device that comes, the iPhone XS, XS Max, it's not clear. It should have this version, this release version of iOS on it at this point. It might have a slightly earlier version. So that can be a problem if your backup is actually a newer version of iOS than the version that is on the device that you're trying to restore to. That will usually be a problem. But I haven't really heard it being a problem the other way around. So my guess is if you do the iCloud over the air, as long as your device has a newer version of iOS than your backup, you should be totally fine. If I'm getting that wrong and anybody has different information, I did a little research on this. I didn't see, and Apple doesn't mention having any problems restoring from an older to a newer version, but and I've never run into that problem. So I'm guessing it's the other way around. I'm guessing maybe, you know, if you bought your iPhone from a carrier store, it might actually have an old version that came out of the factory of iOS on it. So even though it's a new device to you, you think you're restoring from an older version of iOS, but it turns out you're actually running a newer version in the backup on your current iPhone. The battery thing, yeah, absolutely. GPS can totally drain a battery. So I totally understand if someone's using GPS. Also just traveling, you know, another area where you can run into battery issues. You're at a conference or something and you're using your phone a lot. I mean, there are certainly scenarios where you're going to run out of power. I guess I just have found, just like you, I generally, when I know that's going to be the case, I carry a battery pack. I'm assuming maybe the power adapter in your car is broken or something like that, because in my car I use the cigarette lighter adapter, right? Or I guess we don't call them cigarette lighters anymore, right? They're just the power adapter in the car to keep my phone charged when I'm in the car. So I guess that's another reason why I maybe don't run out of battery, is I always seem to be near a charger. And I think I covered it on the show, but now that we have wireless charging, you know, I absolutely love what I have in my car is actually a wireless charger. It's an iAudi, so I don't even have to plug anything into my phone when I get in the car. I just put it in the cradle. It's an iAudi One Touch wireless car charger. And it's a little cradle. It goes in. I have the one that is a vent mount, but they also have one that is a CD mount. So if you have a CD player in your car you don't use anymore, you can actually mount it into that slot. Or they also have one that's just a dashboard mount. And I absolutely love it. I think it's fabulous. I think it costs around $50, so it's not cheap, but it does support the fast wireless charging. So I just literally drop my iPhone in there. And that way, when I'm in the car, I'm charging it. So I'm assuming there must be something technically wrong where you can't do that. But, you know, if not, I would encourage you, get a car charger. And that'll help you when you're using that GPS
in your car. And then just finally, the comments on order day, ordering your iPhone. Yeah, isn't it amazing how any little thing goes wrong and it can put you in this panic state, right? It's gotten to that point where the phones sell out, they start to get delayed. So if you miss the date for any reason, you're suddenly going to be waiting longer for your device. And as Apple fans, we never want to wait longer for our new devices. So I'm totally with you there. Just like I was saying earlier, when I put my order in and I wasn't sure for about 20 or 30 minutes that it actually had gone through, that was a little stressful. And so I totally understand that. I don't think you're alone with that. But thank you for your voicemail and your comments and sharing that stuff with us. I'll also tell you that I got a lot of feedback in the MacCast Slack. That is the private Slack channel that we have for MacCast supporters on Patreon. If you'd like to become a supporter, I would appreciate it. You can check it out and get details at patreon.com/MacCast. But a number of the members in the community were in there, and we were talking about ordering an iPhones and whether we were going to upgrade or not. And it surprised me that there are actually a lot of people planning to upgrade. And it seems like the iPhone XS Max is what a lot of people are going for. So a lot of people ready to have a larger iPhone X. And it surprised me a little bit given the extreme cost, the high price. But it seems like many people are on the Apple's iPhone upgrade program. So I think that's going to actually help get a lot of people past the high cost, because it's really just a small increase to the monthly payment that you're making already. And I was thinking about that and thinking that's really cool on one level, but it's also potentially a little bit dangerous in my mind too. And that's a little bit of my hesitation about the iPhone upgrade program and paying monthly, is it sort of hides the real cost of these devices, even though it's zero interest. And I get all that, you know, like financially it's not any different, but I think that's where the danger might come into play, because financially it's not any different. You get the point, is you're still spending a large amount of money on a device, and you still need to have the money to be able to afford that. And if it's sort of hidden in these little payments, then it seems like you're not spending that much. You're going, oh, it's only $60 a month, or it's only, you know, $50 a month, and it feels like a small amount, but you're actually paying $1,500 in the end for a phone. You know, you could get a laptop for that. Yeah, you can go buy a MacBook. It's kind of crazy when you really start to think too deeply about it. Maybe we don't want to do that, but I think we should. So, you know, just make sure if you're buying a new iPhone, you can afford it. And I think we're all responsible adults here, so we all get that. I don't think we have to harp on it, but just something I was thinking about, because a lot of people are saying, hey, it's just, you know, upgrade program. I'm buying the new one. I'm already set up to get one every year. I'm going for the Plus. I want the 512, the biggest size. And that's great. I think it's fabulous that a lot of people are very excited about that model. But still, there's also, and I heard from a lot of people who said, you know, there's not enough changes this time around. I am not upgrading. I don't feel like I need to upgrade. And I think that's really great too. Apple talked about this at the keynote as part of their environmental efforts, as part of their recycling. They had Lisa Jackson come out and say, look, we want people to keep their devices as long as possible. We want devices in the secondary market to have second and third owners. In my house, an iPhone goes through at least three people, sometimes four people, if we hand it down to members in extended family and stuff like that. So they're often reused and they last a really long time. And I think a lot of people are reacting to this year's upgrades that way as well. It's like, you know what? I'm really happy with my iPhone 6 or 7 or 8 or 8 Plus or whatever it might be. And now that iOS 12 is out, it's actually performing even better. And a lot of the new features of iOS 12 are fully supported on my device. So I just really don't feel like I need to spend that kind of money or to upgrade. And I think that's absolutely fabulous. And I applaud people who are doing that as well. To be honest with you, if I didn't need the iPhone XS to kind of do some of the camera features and use it for the show, I probably would not be upgrading. I wouldn't see a real reason to invest the amount of money that it costs to do that upgrade in a new phone. And I might hold that money out for another device. I might actually be getting an Apple Watch Series 4 instead. But yeah, so I don't know. it's an interesting year for upgrades, I guess, I think is what it comes down to. And everybody sort of has to choose what works for them. The other thing is, I will say the Apple Watch Series 4 seems to be overall, in the email responses and tweets and things I've been getting, the thing that most of you are excited about. Most people seem to be jumping on the Apple Watch Series 4. Almost anybody who has anything up to a Series 2 Apple Watch, up to and including a Series 2 Apple Watch, I'm hearing, yeah, this is the upgrade for me. I'm glad I waited. I'm glad I skipped the Series 3. People with Series 3 seem very happy with their Series 3, unless they're feeling like they want the larger screen size or the additional health monitoring features that the ECG brings for them. But outside of that, again, older devices, older Apple Watches seem ready for the upgrade. I'm surprised how many people I'm hearing from who have a Series 0 watch that are like, yeah, I'm getting a Series 4. I think it's the perfect amount of time. And I think that's probably pretty accurate. The Series 0 was still a very, very good watch. I think now that it doesn't support watchOS 5, it's feeling a little long in the tooth. It has been a little slow. Almost everybody who's emailed me or talked to me about having the Apple Watch Series 0 said, yeah, it was a little bit sluggish, but I was getting by with it. So I'm really ready for an upgrade this year, and this looks like an amazing upgrade. So I'm very excited for anyone who is picking up a new Apple Watch Series 4. And then sort of the final group that I'm hearing from is those of you who are excited about the iPhone XR and the colors and the lower price point and all the great features that are in there. I really think that is going to be the big winner of the year, especially when it comes to iPhones. I think a lot of people are going to be upgrading and buying the iPhone XR, and I fully expect Apple to talk a lot about that at their quarterly results. And I'm excited to see them when they come out. It's going to be a long wait until mid-end of October, but I will be one of the first ones in the Apple Store to take a look at those, and hopefully I don't have a little buyer's remorse about not waiting for that model and buying the iPhone XS. I'm sure I'm going to love the iPhone XS. I really love the iPhone X. The good news on all of this is Apple is making some really great, exciting, and compelling products right now. And I also did hear from some people, I have to be honest, I hear from a lot of you who felt disappointed and let down by this year's keynote and upgrades. And I can understand that on a level too. I personally think these are exciting announcements. I think Apple's moving in the right direction. I think the biggest complaints are, one, that there just weren't enough changes. There weren't enough new things, especially with the iPhone XS. It's a XS, it's an S year, so it is kind of incremental upgrades, so I get that. Some people were disappointed that we didn't hear anything on the Mac side of things or with iPads, but those are still coming, so I think we can hold out hope that there's going to be some big new announcements there. Some people still very upset that Apple's moved away from Touch ID. I'm trying to think of some of the other things that I've heard. Also, just in general, the increase of the cost, the prices. A lot of people aren't too thrilled about Apple pushing up the price points on these, and that I totally get. They're getting really expensive. But I think the flip side of it is that Apple recognizes that fewer and fewer people are going to be upgrading as frequently. So you're sort of extending out that payment. So if you realize that, yes, it costs more up front, but this is a device that has enough power and enough functionality and enough utility that I can hold on to it for 3 or 4 years rather than upgrading every 1 to 2 years. You've now just doubled the value, and it may end up over the life of that device actually costing you a little bit less. So a little bit of perspective, too, I think helps kind of put these things, in perspective. I guess that's the best way to say that. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on all this? I want to hear from more of you. Are you buying new devices? Which ones are you excited about? Are you not buying? Why are you not buying them? Shoot us some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. The other thing that we were talking about on the last episode of MacCast is I talked a little bit about 3D Touch. And I received a lot of feedback about this. I actually said Force Touch on the last episode of the MacCast. So probably where I need to start in the follow-up here is with an email I received from Bart Bouchatz, who wrote in. And I'm bad about using the term Force Touch in a very generic Kleenex kind of way as referring to any of Apple's Force technologies. Bart wrote in and correctly reminded me that the technology that exists in the iPhone is actually called 3D Touch. And the stuff that's in the Apple Watch is Force Touch. And one of the key differences is levels of sensitivity, whereas the Apple Watch just has you press a little bit harder and it detects a press. That's it. It's sort of one level. On the iPhone, 3D Touch actually has a couple levels. It has two different pressure levels. So you have, you start to press, and then you kind of press through that press, and you get a even more forceful press. And this enables a technology that Apple calls peak and pop on the iPhone. Interestingly, the multi-levels of sensitivity, and this may go back to my confusion about the terminology, is that on the trackpad, the Magic Trackpad, it has multiple levels of pressure sensitivity, but there, Apple calls it Force Touch. So again, Apple marketing just trying to confuse and make us, crazy on this stuff. But the point is we're talking about certain things that have multi-levels, and when that is the case on an iOS device, Apple calls that technology 3D Touch. And peak and pop is you start to press and one thing happens, and then if you continue pressing through, it sort of commits it, and then another thing happens. It's often with kind of like dialogues. And the reason I bring this up is because that was one of the big features that a lot of people liked when I asked, what are you using 3D Touch for? What are some of your favorite features? And another thing that Bart pointed out to me was that I had commented that one of the problems I have with 3D Touch is it's kind of like a hidden interface. Like, unless you really know about it, it's not that discoverable. And some people recommended, well, maybe Apple should have some icons and stuff like that, but I think that would just clutter up the interface. So I kind of get why it's a hidden feature. And Bart brought up a perspective that I've heard before and I kind of forgot about, but it does kind of make sense, is that is you can kind of think about 3D Touch on iOS sort of like right-click is on a mouse or a trackpad. Not everybody knows that they can right-click stuff or get a contextual menu, but once you do know about it, there's a lot of additional features and functionality that can become exposed to you. And that's in a lot of ways the way that 3D Touch is used on iOS devices. It adds access to additional options, but not everybody knows it's there. And Bart did mention, I was kind of I and other people have kind of had this double standard about 3D Touch where, we have no problem with right click and we think it's a great feature, yet we're critical of 3D Touch and it's essentially the same thing. So, yeah, I think that's a great point, Bart. I kind of get that and I agree with you. I don't want 3D Touch to go away. That's the thing. I'm worried that it is going away, and we'll talk in a little bit about some of those reasons and my concerns for that. But I want to get back to some of your favorite features for 3D Touch. And again, a big common use that I heard from a lot of you is using the peaking feature. And I even mentioned that was one of my favorite features about it, is sort of peeking in on an attachment in an email so I can kind of preview it, see what it is, I'll swipe up and maybe save it without actually having to open it up or having it launch a different application. I love that feature. I also do it with photos for saving photos and things like that. That are either attachments or in messages and stuff like that. And Bart pointed out, you can do this in email also just to preview a message. And what's cool about doing that is if you're in the message list and you peek on the message in the mail application, you can actually kind of see what it's about. You can look at it, see if it's something you want to continue and pop open to actually read. But if you let go after just peeking at it, it doesn't mark it as read. So you can kind of triage your email in that way without actually marking things as read and leave it in the inbox to get to later. He also mentioned that he uses the feature in Overcast to, they call it dipping in and out of a podcast. So you can preview the show notes or the episode, peek in on it, decide if it's something you want to throw into your playlist queue or listen to, or maybe even delete if you're not interested in that episode. This is a feature that you do need to enable in Overcast. I was trying to do it and it wasn't working. Couldn't figure it out. I had to go in the settings and actually turn it on. So, but that's a cool feature, right? Peeking in on your stuff. And a lot of people mentioned doing that in various areas of iOS using 3D Touch. And I do think that is a great feature. Another very common feature, and I use this one as well, is force pressing to clear all of your notifications in Notification Center. So the little close icon. If you force press on that, it gives you the option to clear all of the notifications. And you can do something similar with Safari tabs, although I did discover that with Safari tabs, it's a press and hold. It's actually not a force touch. And this is actually one of my still issues with force touch and just Apple's technologies around, or through 3D touch, excuse me, and Apple's technologies around 3D touch in general, is that there's not a consistency because not all the devices support 3D touch. Some do, some don't. And you, in a lot of cases, have a feature that on some devices work with a press and hold, but then it's a force touch on devices that support 3D touch. So if you're moving back and forth between them, it becomes very confusing. And I encounter this every day with my iPads, right? Because iPad doesn't do 3D touch. So if I start to learn all these cool 3D touch things, I can, great, do that on my iPhone, but I have a lot of the same apps and do a lot of the same things on my iPad, but it doesn't work over there. So what was the point in learning these sort of secret advanced features if I can't use them all the time? You kind of get the point, right? I think Apple needs to either go all in or go all out and do it a different way. And I have a feeling, unfortunately, based on like the iPhone XR not having 3D touch and iPad still not having 3D touch, that Apple's actually going to move in the other direction and move to gestures that don't rely on the 3D touch or force touching technologies moving forward. And I know that makes some people upset, but I think they're going to replace it with a more common language based on, you know, like tap and hold or the haptic stuff that they're doing in the iPhone XR. I don't know what that's going to be or what it's going to look like, but I have a feeling they're going to enable 3D touch like functionality, but without using 3D touch technology, if that makes any sense. And I think it's, again, so we can get to this common, I think gestures and especially a lot of this, what I call hidden UI stuff, only works or really works best when it's common across the entire line, when there is a common language, as opposed to having multiple variants of the language that you have sort of have to translate and work through. Yeah, I think that's, you know, very confusing, just like regular languages would be. If imagine if you lived in a city and in different regions of the city, everybody spoke a sort of different dialect. And I'm not talking about just like an accent, like a totally different dialect. And you had to switch back and forth between them. But maybe some of that dialect, there was, you know, 50% of the words were shared in common and, you know, or probably more like 80% were in common, but 20% were different. Yeah, you'd be very confused all the time, and I kind of feel like it's that way. But let's move back to some of your favorite uses for 3D Touch. Another favorite use of 3D Touch was to 3D Touch app icons to access quick features. A lot of applications, you can quickly jump into a feature of the application. A few highlights that were pointed out, contacts or the phone application, if you force or 3D press on either one of those application icons, you get a list of your favorite contacts so you can quickly send a message or make a phone call to some of your favorites. Sharing an application. How many times do you have somebody ask, hey, you know, can you send me an email and let me know that application you told me about? Well, you can actually 3D touch on the icon. You know, there's a share option right from there, and you can send them a link through messages or through AirDrop or however you want to do it, directly to that application in the Mac App Store. And that is really convenient. Somebody pointed out that they use 3D Touch in Apple's music application to add items to their playlist. You can also add items to the Up Next list if you're currently listening to a track. So as you're browsing through, you can peek at the track and then slide up and you get a bunch of different options. Also good for liking or disliking a certain track that you happen to be listening to. And I have to admit, though, I often just use Siri for a lot of that, right? Add this track to my Up Next, or add it to this playlist, or like this track, don't like this track. So I've kind of moved more in a lot of ways to voice for a lot of this quick action stuff, but I see how it can be beneficial with 3D Touch. Somebody pointed out that for business, you know, they have like a mileage tracking app or something that integrates with their car, and they can quickly add mileage using a quick shortcut from the application icon. So it does come in very handy, and there's things you could do with notifications. And then Douglas mentioned that he has a 3D touch trick, or he uses the 3D touch trick where you force press on the left side of your screen as you're browsing through the Springboard and slide in, and you can switch back to the last app that you were using in the app switcher, and you can kind of toggle and switch back and forth doing this over and over again. And I had kind of forgotten about that feature. I thought it went away for a while, and I was like, well, I should try it again. And of course, I pull out my iPhone 10, try to use it, and it doesn't work because that has the new gesture-based thing. I don't have a home button. And so it uses the gesture app switcher where you swipe up from the bottom and you access the app switcher. It doesn't support that 3D touch gesture. And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier. So you have some devices where Douglas's great trick, which is really cool, works. And then you have other devices where it doesn't work. So Douglas says, hey, I do this all the time. And I go to try it and I'm frustrated because I'm like, why is it not working? Why does this not work? And, you know, that's, I know, not new. You know, we've had different things that work differently on different devices. I get that this is not new, but these things are things that become annoying to users when you don't have this consistency and support the same way across all devices, which again is why I think Apple ultimately is ditching 3D touch and they're going to go with some other hybrid of the technology or some other version of the technology that can be supported on all of their devices without the actual 3D touch, you know, hardware technology needing to be used. So we'll have to see where they go, but just based on the stuff that was in the keynote, that seems to me to be the direction they're moving in. I could be totally wrong. If you think I'm wrong, shoot me some feedback, send me some emails. Also, please continue to send your 3D touch tips and tricks, your force touch tips and tricks for watchOS. Almost everything I got was related this time around to the iPhones. And I know there's some things that you can do with force pressing on Apple Watch, although there it tends to be less of the extra features. And a lot of times it ends up being the main way you have to access a feature inside an app. And maybe that's where I started my aversion. You know, that's what started my aversion to force touch. So maybe it's really force touch that I'm not a big fan of, and 3D touch I like a little bit better. I have to think about that a little bit more. But regardless, send me your feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Okay, one more thing that I want to talk to you about, and this came up, I probably could have covered this in the news portion, but I really wanted to focus on the tip and trick aspect of this. You may have seen this in the blogs or maybe on Twitter. There was an uproar created on Twitter this week from a tweet from a guy who used to live in Australia, moved to Canada recently, took his iTunes library with him, his iTunes purchased movies and stuff like that, was now in Canada going through his library using and had switched over to using the Canadian iTunes store, and noticed that three of his movies he couldn't watch. They were totally missing from his library. So it looked like Apple had deleted movies from his library, something that Apple does not do. They didn't show up, basically. I guess they weren't in his library, but they also weren't in his purchases. I should be clear about this. So they were not in his purchase history when he was looking in iTunes. The movies were Cars, Cars 2, and Grand Budapest Hotel. I'm not really sure that that matters too much, because it could have really been any movies. So basically, he couldn't re-download them. They were just gone. And so he contacted Apple support, I believe through Twitter, and they kind of said, yeah, they're not available to download because they're not, those versions are not available in the Canadian iTunes store, and you've moved your account over to the Canadian iTunes store. And we've talked about this in the past on the MacCast, the fact that Apple has always, in their terms of service, as it relates to media on iTunes, they do not promise that any of your purchased media will always be available on their servers. It's part of the problem that I have with people just keeping stuff in iCloud, especially when it comes to purchases. And we've seen this with apps, too. An app developer just suddenly decides they're not going to make the app anymore. They may leave it on there. They may not. So you're not always guaranteed to have access to that. For that very reason, and I've talked about it on the show, Apple recommends, and I would recommend to you as well, that you always, when you make a purchase, download a copy of that purchase and store it somewhere. You know, pull down, click the cloud icon, download it. In my case, the way I handle this is I have my main Mac with my main iTunes library, and everything I ever purchase is downloaded there. And then I have ChronoSync set up to back up my entire library to a Drobo, and I also have my cloud backup, Backblaze, set to back up my entire library to the cloud. So I have two copies always, and the copy that is set up with ChronoSync is set up that even if I delete the file in my local iTunes library, so I can delete it, not have to have it stored on my Mac, it will not sync deletions. So it keeps that downloaded copy local. And so then I can still stream it. I can still re-download it. I'm not taking up all the storage space on my internal iTunes library, but I know that that movie file or TV show or whatever is backed up. And the reason that Apple can't promise that that purchased media will always be there available for download is not Apple's fault. It is the licensing deals that they have to do with the studios. The studio isn't in control of that. And if the studio decides we don't want Apple to be able to license our movies anymore, they can pull them down. There's also a situation where for government rules or regulations, you know, they have different censorship laws. They have different things that you're allowed to see. Movies might be re-edited or changed or altered in certain ways for certain countries. So the version of a movie in one country might not be the same version that's licensed to iTunes in another country. So they have different licenses for different countries. This stuff gets really, really complicated. And all of that can impact what's available on iTunes when, and it can change at any moment. These deals change. They might not get renewed. And Apple specifically tells you that you are responsible for backing up copies of your purchased movies. So, you know, I'm not saying this guy should have known that, but they've been pretty clear about that. And, you know, this caused a big outrage, and a lot of people were very frustrated and angry at Apple. But in this case, it really came down to an issue of where the films were bought. They were bought on the Australian Apple Store. Most of the stuff was downloadable and available on the Canadian Apple Store. Three films weren't. I don't know. I didn't read how big his collection was. But, you know, like, for example, I have, I think, 200 movies, maybe more, in my iTunes collection that I've just accrued over the years. And I can imagine some of those, you know, not being available. So Apple support did point out he could switch back to the Australian iTunes store to download the films. The problem there is, yeah, you can switch back, but you need to have your iTunes account attached to a credit card or a payment method that is local in that country. And I think, unfortunately for this guy, he didn't have a Canadian bank account or Canadian credit card or Australian bank account or Australian credit cards anymore. So he couldn't switch back to the Australian store to re-download those movies. The way, of course, to handle this would be, if you know you are going to be moving regions, make sure you download all of your purchases first, have them in the local iTunes library, then you can switch over and you can put anything back in that's not re-downloadable. Yes, it's a big hassle. Yes, it's a big pain in the butt. I totally get it. Buying digital versions of anything can be a bigger hassle than just getting the physical product, right? Because if you had a physical DVD or a Blu-ray or a CD, you can just re-rip it, you can put it back in, whatever you want. The point is, though, is Apple is, they don't want this to be difficult. In a perfect world, they would, I bet you, they would love this stuff to be DRM and region-free. By the way, we had this problem with DVDs, right? You had DVDs that would only play on certain players in certain countries. You ever encounter this? This is not new stuff. And so their hands are really tied by this paranoid movie industry and studios who enforce all these regulations and restrictions, and they put these on companies like Apple. So if it does bother you, yeah, buy physical stuff, buy a thing. A lot of DVDs come with digital codes now. Big problem I have with that is the digital codes are often locked into a single platform, so you might end up on Ultraviolet. Ugh. We do have Movies Anywhere now, which kind of helps with this a little bit. You can, of course, rip your own copies, but that's also technically illegal if we want to really get down to the nitty-gritty of it. So you're not supposed to be doing that. You're breaking the law in a lot of cases to enable that feature. So it's all just a giant pain in the butt. We get it. I will tell you, you know, another thing that you could do that might help with the streaming, especially if licenses, where things are licensed, change, is use Movies Anywhere If you're in the U.S., I'm not sure how many countries Movies Anywhere is available in, but you can tie your Amazon purchases, your Hulu purchases, your Vudu purchases, which is Walmart, I think, your iTunes, everything into Movies Anywhere. I think it works with Disney's service. And then anything you purchase on any of those platforms is unlocked and available on anywhere. So it doesn't matter where you buy it. You could access it through any one of those services or platforms. And so that will make your stuff more portable. So even if, you know, you bought it on iTunes and it's in Movies Anywhere, if iTunes loses their license to that content, chances are maybe Vudu will still have it, or Amazon Prime will still have it, or Movies Anywhere might still have access to that content. So you can still watch it from another application. Yes, it wouldn't be as convenient if you're in the Apple ecosystem, but at least you would still have ownership of that content. So bottom line, always download and backup local copies of your purchased iTunes media. And that's everything, not just movies, TV shows, and music. If you bought it outright, download it, save a copy, back it up, and you will be protected from this. So that's my advice to you. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, also TextExpander for iOS and PDF Pen for iPhone, iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out our Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.